Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 13th, 2005. This session, Take Off Your Shoes, The Challenge to the Faithful Prophet, presented by Rabbi Robert Marks in the Fireside Room. Disc number MAR-2005-08. Let's listen in.
There is, of course, first of all, the text itself. The text itself with all of its holiness and sacredness. A holiness that, whether we are literalists or not, whether we are absolutely orthodox or not, has its history and tradition that has been invested by centuries of people reading this and finding in it things that have molded their lives and changed their lives. There is that holiness that comes from what surely was the presence of God in so many people's lives. But secondly, there's the creative process. This text is alive. It is alive for us, first of all, because all of us are here seeking to draw from it the things that are so valuable. It is alive for us. It gives us new meaning. It's like a rich mine, and we are digging in that mine, continually seeking to explore it. The tools that we use are the tools that all of you are familiar with. You have used them. The pastors that are here have studied them, and you've studied them in church, all of you. I've studied them in my synagogue classes. They are the commentaries, the texts, and the translations, and we realize that what most of us are using is a translation from the original Hebrew, some of which is poetic in itself. I happen to think that the King James Version of the Bible is a miracle in itself, that a committee of people could create such great literature is absolutely fantastic. And after all, the King James Version was created by a committee appointed by the King of England, who was able to come out with something that was so magnificent. At the same time, we know that some of the words are not literal translations of the Hebrew, and that allows us to compare, to continually look for the process. When we sit together, we use the process of Midrash. Midrash, which is a very loose word and yet a specific word, simply for sermons of teachers, or for little gems, little jewels that were found in somebody's idea, somebody's sermon, somebody's teaching, somebody sitting together and hearing somebody way in the back there saying, well, what about this, Rabbi? And somebody else sitting there says, I'm going to put that in my book. And it becomes part of the vast collection known as Midrash. And there are many collections of Midrash. And in addition, we're reading commentators and over the centuries. Our text this summer has been Take Off Your Shoes. And in the almost two weeks that I've been here, we started with the political implications of that process. We started with the very first words of Exodus, there arose a new king who knew not Joseph, and saw immediately how the process of the Bible changed from focusing on families, beautiful families, loving families, tragically dysfunctional families, families where brothers killed one another, families where there always seemed to be sibling rivalry, families where fertility could be a problem, inheritance could be a problem, family quarrels, family reconciliation. All of a sudden, we start to think, as the transition takes place through a little baby Moses, drawn from the bulrushes, drawn from the river by the daughter of Pharaoh, Moses, who goes into the house of Pharaoh, and all of a sudden, we start thinking not of families, but a people of nations, of the children of Israel and Egypt. It's no longer Joseph and Pharaoh. It now becomes the children of Israel and slavery in the land of Egypt. I pointed out before, as a result of that Passover Seder that has been historic in my mind, that I conducted in a little town called Sterling, Illinois, where I suddenly was talking about the Egyptians and the cruelty of the Egyptians, and found out that sitting before me was a table of Egyptians. That I had to be very careful of any stereotype, even a biblical stereotype. It was not all the Egyptians. But Egypt becomes a metaphor. And in Jewish tradition, I think it's interesting to note that Egypt became much more than a metaphor. It became a state of mind. Because Egypt became sort of a code word for slavery, for persecution, for sadness. I think you're aware that when one makes a pilgrimage to Israel, or when one decides to settle in Israel, they do what the phrase is, I have made Aliyah, to make Aliyah. I'm sure some of you have heard that phrase. I've made Aliyah. Aliyah means going up. Egypt was Yerida, was going down. Forget the Egypt-Israel stuff and say, understand that slavery was down. Slavery was always tragedy and sadness. And the memory of slavery is a source of inspiration. It is what moves us to be compassionate, to act with understanding, to deal with one another in a way that is filled with love rather than with contempt. The Midrash was a way of dealing with these events and drawing them out of their historical context and making them very real. One of the commentators, a man by the name of Malbin, pointed out that the first awareness that Moses has of God is as he sees a bush burning and he's told to take off his shoes. Take off your shoes, our summer theme. For the place in which you stand is holy ground. Malbin comments that it is not easy to take off your shoes in a wild place. I think it was Peter sitting here with us today who pointed out that on July 4th, it occurred to the staff that it might be a good thing here at Holden Village to take off shoes and to walk barefoot. And that proved, Peter, as I recall, you're saying, a much more difficult thing than anyone had imagined. Say amen if I'm right.
Yeah, those stones out there can really bite into the bottom of your
feet. There you go. They can bite into your feet, says Peter. It was Malbin who commented that Moses was commanded to take off his shoes because by taking off his shoes, he was feeling the suffering of the thousands of people and those sharp stones, feeling the suffering of the people who were enslaved. You see, the idea of the Midrash and the commentary, in this case, a man by the name of Malbin, who lived hundreds of years ago, was to make us feel what the Bible is telling us in such shorthand, with such so few verses, so clearly and so tensely. And Moses' first act, of course, before he becomes aware of God's presence, is an act that comes from within him. He has an inner sense of justice which seems to qualify him for what happens later on. He sees the taskmaster beating a slave, and something impossible to describe. The Bible doesn't describe it. Just said he looked this way and that, and he saw there was no man. What does it mean, he saw there was no man? One could say Moses was very furtive, that he was afraid. He was afraid. Nobody was there to do the task. Nobody was there. Nobody was looking. So he strikes down the taskmaster. But one could also say, as the Midrash would say, that Moses looks this way and that, and there was nobody acting like a mature adult human being to stop this. There was no man there. Nobody. And so Moses intervened. But his first act is that impulsive act, and for that, he loses his double identity. He loses his identity as an Egyptian. After all, he's the prince in the royal family. He should be feeling secure in what he does. After all, prince can do away with anyone he wants to do, but Moses can't do that. And the next day he sees two Israelites quarreling, and they say to him, "You're going to do to us what you did to the Egyptian." And no longer is Moses an Israelite. He's not an Egyptian. He's not an Israelite. He's instead in the wilderness, all of a sudden married to somebody who he doesn't, unfortunately, love, at least historically love her, in the sense that most of you in this room love someone in your life, because the symbol of Moses is he's not with his wife Zipporah, he's not with his family, he's up in the mountains, taking care of his sheep, his goats. He's in the desert wilderness and all of a sudden meets God there. The first act is take off your shoes. That's been what's occupied us. But before we end this series, we have to understand that merely the act of holy is not enough. And now today we're going to see, through our distinguished reader of the day, we're going to see what happens. So will you please turn in your Bibles to Exodus chapter 4. Exodus chapter 4, and we will read verses 1 to 14. Wait a minute. Let's do it instead. Let's start with 3, verse 14, just to get a flavor of this, because Moses asked God, you'll remember, those of you who were here yesterday, what name God has, and God said to Moses, verse 14, "I am that I am," or literally, "Ehiye asher ehiye," since there's no present tense of the verb am, it is ehiye, "I will be what I will be," and that, preachers, opens the door to infinite preaching possibilities about the meaning of God, a God who will be what God will be. That's another test. Go ahead, verse 14.
God said to Moses, "I am who I am." He said further, "Thus you shall say to the Israelites, I am has sent me to you." God also said to Moses, "Thus you shall say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this my title for all generations. Go and assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, the Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have given heed to you and to what has been done to you in Egypt. I declare that I will bring you up out of misery of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey. They will listen to your voice, And you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. Let us now go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness, so that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. I know, however, that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my wonders, and I will perform in it.
Here's God's promise is here. Now the first thing that happens is that God says to Moses, before even he reveals his name, if you'll just turn back to verse 6 of this chapter, verse 6 of chapter 3, for he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. That's the revelation of his life. And then God gives him a new theology. And immediately it seems to me God is saying, he's not going to understand this. So then he goes back to the verses that we just heard read. And he said, I'm the God of thy fathers, and I'm going to deliver the people. It's sort of like reassurance. This is who I am. I'm the God of thy father. My name is Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh. But forget that for the time being, because you're not going to be able to handle that for 2,000 years. Maybe you're not going to be able to handle it at all. But this is what I want you to do. In other words, there's a mission there. Now, go on to chapter 4, and this is what I want to deal with today. Okay?
Then Moses answered, But suppose they do not listen to me, or listen to me, but say, The Lord did not appear to you. The Lord said to him, What is that in your hand? He said, A staff. And he said, Throw it on the ground. So he threw the staff on the ground, and it became a snake. And Moses drew back from it. Then the Lord said to Moses, Reach out your hand and seize it by the tail. So he reached out his hand and grasped it, and it became a staff in his hand, so that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared.
And notice how it appears again. Again and again and again. God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And those of you who were here yesterday will certainly recall I suggested that this implies three different gods. If you're a Trinitarian, you could use this as evidence that even in the Bible, there were, three in one, if you wanted to do that. We as Jews simply say that each one of them understood God in a unique way. It was one God, but they saw God in three, as all of us do, in different ways. If you were to attempt to get a definition of God out of this room, we would have the Tower of Babel built right in. I guarantee that would happen, because each person sees God in a different way, even though we've been taught over and over again how we should look at God. Each one of us would feel some presence in some unique way, and I think that's why we're here. Go ahead.
Again, the Lord said to him, Put your hand inside your cloak. He put his hand into his cloak, and when he took it out, his hand was leprous, as white as snow. Then God said, Put your hand back into your cloak. So he put his hand back into his cloak, and when he took it out, it was restored like the rest of his body. If they will not believe you or heed the first sign, they may believe the second sign. If they will not believe even these two signs or heed you, you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground. And the water that you shall take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. But Moses said to the Lord, O my Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor even now that you have spoken to your servant. But I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. Then the Lord said to him, Who gives speech to mortals? Who makes them mute or deaf, seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you are to speak. But he said, O my Lord, please send someone else. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, What of your brother Aaron, the Levite? I know that he can speak fluently. Even now he is coming out to meet you.
Okay. That's it. What do you make of all this? Let's hear you now. I've talked an awful lot this morning, more than I'm used to doing so early in the morning. What do you think of all this? What do you think of Moses at this stage?
Moses doesn't think he's up for the job.
He sure doesn't, does he? He's... What else?
He's not afraid to argue with God.
He's not afraid to argue with God. I'm not sure he's fully convinced of who he's talking to yet, right?
He hasn't had a whole lot of time to think about any of this. Went from a burning bush to miracles to responsibility.
Okay. Sure. All right, good. Thank you. These are all helpful. What else? What do you think of Moses?
Most of us would do the same thing. He's like most of us. Uh-huh. So we can't do that.
It always seems like the people who want the power aren't humble, but he was very humble. He didn't want the job, but God chose him anyway. Was it because he was humble?
Okay, well, that's a good question. Was it because he was humble? Well, one of the Midrashim that we read said it was because while taking care of a sheep, he showed concern for a sheep, which I think is pretty memorable that he went and traced this lost goat who had run away and was thirsty, and he gave it water, and God looks at this and says, whoever is capable of taking care of my little lost lamb is capable of taking care of my people Israel. But why would God say that about the little lost lamb when he's also saved an Israelite from being bound to death? See, he's done an act which requires, in most of our opinions, a lot more courage. What else can you say? What else do you think of Moses?
That act in which he saves the Israelite from being beaten by the Egyptian was also an act of murder. Because I think if he was a prince of Egypt, wouldn't there be an alternative with his order itself to have it ceased? But he chose to murder.
There would be an alternative, and it's fascinating that the Midrash, that there is no Midrash on that possibility, that he was a prince of Egypt. And I know why there's no Midrash that says he could have done this as a prince of Egypt. I've raised this question over and over again. Why was Moses afraid after he killed the taskmaster if he was a prince of Egypt? Why is there no explanation? First of all, it's very elliptical. Moses kills the taskmaster, then the next day he sees two Jews arguing, and they say to him, are you going to do what you did to the taskmaster? And Moses has to flee into the wilderness. Why isn't there some justification in the Midrash? I have an answer in my mind to it, but what do you think? Why would that not be? What would the Midrash want to do with Moses? It wants to make him not an Egyptian, but an Israelite. Okay. So that his sympathies have got to be with Israel, and at the same time, Moses is finding it so difficult. No, as I read these passages, the thing that comes clear and the thing that we have to understand is the absolute reluctance of Moses to assume leadership. His struggle with God. He doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to become the leader. And you know, that happens. Yes.
But yesterday, I think it's... I'm confused because yesterday your teaching was...
That really was yesterday, Peter.
Go ahead. Yeah, it was very profound for me that you said... When he turned his head, there was something before he took off his sandals. He turned his head. That indicated he had to do something to be ready to see God, to accept God. And so he's ready, and then later he's not ready.
Mm-hmm. And that bothers you.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
I mean, if you were ready to see God, if that's really what turning your head meant, and then you saw God, I mean, that would, regardless of what you would be told at that point, I would think your faith would be not like ours.
Can I ask this? Is one's faith that linear?
Yeah, the experience was not what he expected.
It was not what, you know, you can say, I'm ready for this, and then something comes along. Look, a confession, okay, little confession. When I entered the Hebrew Union College, I was 16 years old. 16 years old, okay? And I completed my undergraduate work at college, and my first year at Divinity School, you pastors will appreciate this, I did it in the same year, you know, I was 16 years old, I had completed 2 years of college, I was on the verge of 17, I completed 2 years of college, I started when I was 15, and here I was 16 years old, not yet at my 17th birthday, and the college sent me out for the high holidays to a pulpit in Lexington, Mississippi. I hope the people in Lexington, Mississippi will forgive me for this. I took a train in those days. It was right at the end of the war. Took a train down to Lexington, Mississippi. And the college sent me instructions. They said, all you do is take the prayer book and give it. Because I hadn't even gone to a course at the Hebrew Union College. All you do is take a prayer book and you conduct the service. And this will be a good experience for you. And then you come into your seminary and you'll talk about what experiences you had. So 16-year-old little guy, I arrived. I was thinner. I didn't have the pot belly. I didn't have the beard. I did have hair. I arrived in Lexington, Mississippi. I take the service and the sermon. I'm ready for the sermon. So I said, I'm so glad to be here. I'm going to be here for 2 weeks in the midst of you in Lexington, Mississippi. Now, if any of you need marital counseling. So help me. I get that. Obviously, I have never in my own mind lived it down. Now, I did not understand what the laughter in the congregation meant. I was totally naive. Okay, so my point, Peter, is here I was on the verge of a holy mission. I was about to enter the Hebrew Union College. And the first thing I did was a horrible mistake, okay, which has lived with me. I'm serious. I laugh about it now. But when I think of the, you know, what that message was sending to people, what I was saying, you know, it's embarrassing to think about it. It's embarrassing that I'm aware that I'm blushing a little bit as I talk about it. Now here's Moses standing there at the burning bush, and he's had this whole, you know, he's had this holy moment. But then he withdraws from it. He pulls back, and he says, I'm not up to it. You know, that happened before. I'm not going to ask you to turn to Jeremiah chapter 1, but you know the Bible. You remember Jeremiah chapter 1 where God says, Jeremiah, you're going to be a prophet? And Jeremiah says, I can't do that. I'm a child. I can't speak. He was about 40 years old at the time, but he said he was a child. There's always that age question. But anyhow, Jeremiah says, I can't speak. Moses is saying that. Moses is saying, I can't speak doubly, and the Bible is telling us, Moses is saying, I have a physical disability that I can't speak. I stutter. I'm slow of speech. And you will remember, I'm not going to repeat it, that midrash about Moses having touched the coal instead of the king's crown, which was a story explaining why the Bible says Moses is slow of speech, because we have to explain everything. And he put the burning finger in his mouth, and then he stuttered ever after that. But Moses feels totally inept. And what is fascinating is this dialogue goes back and forth between Moses and God. And let's see now what one of our commentaries says about it. If you will, please, turn to page Midrash Rabbah, the Midrash Rabbah, Shemot 3, verse 4. And Midrash Rabbah means simply the great Midrash, the great collection of the Midrash, which was put together over the years. And Shemot is the Hebrew name for Exodus. Shemot, because Exodus starts, Elah Shemot, these are the names of the children of Israel. Biblical books are named in Hebrew after the first words in Hebrew of the text itself. In other words, Genesis is Bereshit, and because the Bible starts Bereshit bara Elohim et Hashemayim ve'etar, it's the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Bereshit, in the beginning. Shemot, these are the names. Okay? Dvorim, these are the things that's Deuteronomy. Okay? Bamidbar is Numbers. Okay? Let's read.
So did Moses plead before God. Lord of the universe, didst thou not promise Jacob when he went into Egypt, I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again? Now dost thou tell me, go and I will send thee unto Pharaoh? It was not I who promised him.
Stop that for just a minute. I think that's wonderful. See, the Bible doesn't have much of a sense of humor when it comes to Moses. It has a sense of humor when it comes to Sarah. Sarah has a wonderful sense of humor. She goes into the tent when she's told she's pregnant and says, she giggles. I love that laugh. That laugh lasts me through the whole book of Genesis. When this 90-year-old lady is told she's going to have a baby and she laughs, that is a belly. That is so wonderful that you can laugh. Moses doesn't do much laughing. One thing Moses lacks is a sense of humor, I think. But here in the Midrash, he has a sense of humor. He says, I didn't say that, you said it. So what are you putting this on me? All of a sudden, why me? Okay, go ahead.
Now dost thou tell me, go and I will send thee unto Pharaoh. It was not I who promised him, and I will also surely bring thee up again.
R is always
Rabbi.
Yeah, Rabbi Nahorai.
Rabbi Nahorai gives another interpretation. Who am I? Moses said to God, thou dost tell me to go and bring out Israel. Where can I give them shelter in summer from the heat and in winter from the cold? Where can I obtain a sufficiency of food and drink? How many midwives have they? How many pregnant women? How many babes? What food hast thou prepared for their midwives? What kind of delicacies hast thou prepared for those pregnant? How many parched grains and nuts hast thou prepared for the little ones?
Okay. All right, stop. You have two arguments here. Let's make sure we have them, okay? Two arguments that Moses has that are not ancient. They're very modern. What are they? Let's recapitulate what in this midrash so far. What's the first one?
It's not my response.
How'd you get me into this, right? Why am I involved in this? I mean, you're the guy. I can't help reading this midrash. And excuse me, I promised when I came up to Holden Village 6 years ago for the first time, I would not be political. I cannot help but think of the Iraq War when I read this passage. Both parts of it. Do you see what I'm saying, anybody? Don't sit here. Help me. Somebody say something. Disagree with me. Say something.
Why us?
Yeah.
Why us as a country?
You know, who said this? You know, how did we get into it? Okay,
the second part is the post-war strategy.
Yeah.
Look at all the...
Did you see that?
Yeah.
Yeah, who's provided for the electricity and the... He's talking... Now, here's the humanitarian part of it. What, you know, you're getting me into this thing. What plans have you made for getting me out of it? What plans have you made for the water system working and terrorism.
Yeah, impractical. Where are the provisions? Yes.
Right. Do you see why I'm thinking of this? And it's so clear because that seems to be the dilemma. That it's a very modern midrash, in a sense. Okay.
Since it's one thing to lead the parade, but I mean, who's going to take care of everything else?
Who's going to take what? Moses is saying, you haven't told me anything about this. Now, the third thing that he's objecting to is down at the bottom. Lord of the universe, read that with Gary. Lord of the universe, how can I? The fourth last slide, Lord of the universe. Before the break.
Oh, Lord of the universe, how can I enter a place of robbers and murderers? This is what he meant by, who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh?
Well, the third argument, so here you have his three arguments, right? Very, very graphic. One is, I'm getting into something that I have no business meddling with. I didn't say I was going to get into that. Two, what's the strategy? What's the plan? What's the escape plan? What's going on? And three, I'm scared out of my pants. I got to go back there. I just got out of there. And these are tough guys down there. I don't want to do a stint of duty down there anymore. I'm happy with my sheep out here. I'm very content. I'm just relaxed. And why should I have to do this now? This is the danger, but. Let's read one more commentary, or actually two more, and we'll see, and then we'll attempt to draw this to a close, okay? Read the other side of that page if you have. This is quotations that Aviva Zornberg, who's written a very lovely, from a women's point of view, commentary on the book of Exodus. It's called The Particulars of Rapture. And she quotes in her statement two rabbis. Let's see what they say. Our reader of the day. Rabbi Nehemiah said,
God said to Moses, the anguish of my children in Egypt is revealed and known to me, as it is said, God saw the children of Israel and God knew. My children dwell in anguish and you dwell at ease. And I seek to set them free from Egypt. And you say to me, send by whose hand you shall send.
And what does that mean? What's the problem here? What is Rabbi Nehemiah talking about? Let's make sure we understand it. What is Moses continually saying to God? Send by whose hand you will send, but don't send me. You know, by whose hand you will send, but don't send me. Do you realize the sarcasm here? You know, here you're saying, God said to Moses, the anguish of my children is revealed and known to me, and you, Moses, are dwelling at ease, and you get into conversation with me, you go to the burning bush, you take off your shoes, you say, boy, I'm feeling holy. Look at this argument against the religious person of indifference. The religious person who sits in church or synagogue Sunday morning, Friday night, Shabbat morning, and says, oh, isn't that awful? What's going on in the world? You complain about it, you say what's... But don't send me. Don't get me involved. Send who you want to send. Send who you want to send. A little bit of biography. I'm in a autobiographical mood today, so forgive me. I remember during the civil rights days, we worked closely with Martin Luther King in Chicago. I had met Martin Luther King through a very good and quaint friend of mine. He was quaint, quite consciously. His name was Kibbe Kaplan. Kibbe Kaplan was a tanner from Boston, ran a huge tanning corporation, and he was the president, a Jewish guy, who was the president of the National NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. That was the phrase, and it's still a very prominent organization. Kibbe Kaplan used to come to my house and bring giant Steve toys. He had a closet full of Steve toys, dolls. You know, Steve, does that name anything? The old timers will remember the Steve toys. They were beautiful dolls, and he would bring them for the kids. And he wore these big keep smiling. He was a character. Wore big keep smiling buttons. And one day he introduced me to Martin Luther King, and said we ought to get to know one another. And then King sent me a telegram, and I went down to Selma, Alabama, and was involved in that a little bit. Well, King came to Chicago, and the Commission on Human Relations in Chicago, since I was at that time the head of the reform movement in Chicago, Mayor Daley's office asked me to go to Marquette Park, where there were going to be a march on a Sunday, and they were worried about the possible violence that would take place there. And I remember taking my son, my young son, with me. I thought we would sit on the curb and watch, just sort of be observers. We were going to be observers of what happened as things developed. So, and here I was the head of a movement, so I had to, all the bishops who were here would be appreciative of this, that you got to be careful of any political involvement because unless there's some higher synod leading up that has the authority of God, you can't do anything, or you've got to be careful about what you do. That's one of the traps of leadership, is that when you start representing people, the trouble with being a church authority is that you're bound by the rules. So there I was sitting there, and all of a sudden a small group of people came by with Martin Luther King at the head, and people started cursing and yelling and throwing stones. And as this group came closer, something happened. I got up from the curb, and my son and I walked into the middle of the street, and I walked with Martin Luther King. And from then on, was with him on several occasions. The problem, as I wrote about it later on, incidentally, and one of the subsequent marches, television picked it up, and somebody threw a stone, and it hit me while I was walking. And friends in New York called me and said, "Bobby, were you hurt?" Now, don't ever call me Bobby. they had Bobby Kennedy, in New York, so any Robert was Bobby. "Bobby, are you hurt?" And I remember saying, I'm telling this for a purpose that's not about me, but about what goes on in terms of what Moses was afraid of. And I said very glibly, because this had been picked up on television, I said, "No, I wasn't hurt. I really wasn't hurt." And then I thought for a moment, and I said, "Yes, I was hurt, but not by the stone, but by the hatred, but by the possibility that it was decent white people who went to churches and, for all I know, synagogues, who did this, who cursed and threw stones. That was a very deep hurt." And what I admired, and wrote this in a letter I wrote to our congregations,
was, you know, anybody can do this once. What the true leader does, and what Martin Luther King, and the reason he was really a great leader, was that he did this over and over and over again. Not just, he didn't have his one moment of greatness, his one moment of courage. He did it over and over and over again. And that's what Moses was afraid of. Moses, in a sense, foresaw this. He foresaw what was going to have to happen to him. And he's saying, don't sin. Let's see the other reason now. Go to Rabbi, and here, for the sake of our reader, I know you're going to pronounce this, Rabbi Yosef Haglili. Okay, go on. What did he say?
God said to Moses, my children in Egypt deserve total destruction. As it is said, I said to them, each of you throw away the detestable things that you are drawn to, and do not defile yourselves with the fetishes of Egypt. But they defiled me and refused.
They defied me.
Defied me and refused to listen to me. But I have decided to act for the sake of my great name, so that it is not profaned. And I seek to set them free from Egypt. And you said to me, send by whose hand you will send.
Okay, first of all, the sarcasm again. You're saying that to me again? And Moses says it two or three places in the text we've read. What does this passage say? Let's have some of your comments here. What does it say? What's different? Read it carefully.
The children don't really deserve to be saved.
They don't deserve to? Why not?
Because they defy.
They're watching too much television. They want their big SUVs. They don't care about the environment. Okay, I mean, modern terms. What are they doing? They're doing everything, you know. They've forgotten their faith. They don't deserve to be saved, but then what? That's part of it.
Well, they decided.
What?
But I decided to save me.
Why did God decide to save me? Why? This is the crux of what I'd like to leave you with today. Why does God decide to save me?
Because of the sake of God's own name.
Because of God's name. What does that mean, though, Pastor?
Because God is love, and he has this irrational love of us.
His irrational love because of his name? Okay. Yes. That's good. What else? Yes.
He promised.
Good. All of you are right. You know, you're right and you're right. But there's not right. But look at this. Look at what is contained in this powerful little passage. For the sake of God's name.
So that it won't be profaned, that it won't be disrespected.
And why shouldn't it be disrespected? In other words, what does it mean so that God wouldn't profane his name? Why? Because he's promised. And when God promises, according to the Midrash, that promise has to be kept. We have to. When we promise to do something, we've got to do it. Now look at what, there's a ton of stuff here. First of all, one could say that God has to do this because God is God. God is love. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do it because I promised I'm going to do it. Because I don't want to profane my name. I've said I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. But the third reason is that what's going on is unjust. It's terrible. God cannot stand that. Now, of course, as we discovered yesterday, one idea of God is that God is capable of intervening. But what God is saying here now is that how does God intervene? God intervenes through us, through you, Moses. Through you who are sitting here, who got to get off your duffs when you leave here and do what you have to do. But not just say, isn't it terrible?
But not just go out and take care of your sheep, your own flocks, you pastors that, you know, who are the shepherds of flocks, and go back and take care and deliver your sermons. We all do that. I'm not criticizing you. I do it too. It's so easy to, you know, Mark Twain had that wonderful aphorism Renita, you were telling me about Mark Twain, I think. And we're talking about Huckleberry Finn. He has that marvelous aphorism, anyhow, in Following the Equator, in which he says these words, which have been a motto in my life because they are so characteristic of what human beings do. Mark Twain said, to do good is noble. To tell others how to do good is nobler and less trouble. But it is for God's name, it is because God is God, that you, Moses, have to stop saying, hey, send whom thou wilt send. Now, two other strands, and then I want to bring this to a close. Because tomorrow I think I'm going to have time for anyone who would like to deal with questions. I hope there'll be more open discussion. And then I want to deal with the final moments in Moses' life. That's what I want to do before I get on that mystical lady of the lake tomorrow and sail off into, you know, a Garden of Eden. Or leave the Garden of Eden. In exile from the Garden of Eden. Two more things. Moses is told by God, look, your brother's coming to see you. Brother's coming to see you. Isn't this interesting? Why do I say it's interesting? Anybody quickly have a thought before I quickly tell you?
Thought he was out in the wilderness.
He's out, well, you know, it's like God has sent the characters out there. Here's all of a sudden Aaron's out in the wilderness to meet his brother. But my question, too, has to do with Genesis. Moses and his brother get along well. They're not Cain and Abel. They're not Jacob and Esau. They're not Joseph and his brothers. They love one another.
How do we know that? Moses was raised by Pharaoh, by Pharaoh's daughter.
Maybe that's why. You got it. I think she's got it. But all of a sudden they're together. And Moses and Aaron is acting as Moses' staff, his voice, his commander-in-chief, his aide. We know that they're working together, right? We know that. They're pretty good. We don't know why they do that. It may have been that absence has made the heart grow fonder. Who knows? One other thing. And here are the Midrash comments on something that is a good thing for us to ponder on. If you will, for just one second, take a look at Exodus 5, verse 1. Exodus 5, verse 1. Just for one second, and I'm going to comment on that and then let you go. Okay, just read the first part.
Afterwards, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, thus
okay,
says...
Okay, that's all. I want you to read. You've done very well.
Thank you.
The Bible tells us that Moses and Aaron talked to the Israelites and they agreed that they've got to be liberated. They want their freedom. They want an end to their suffering. They are unanimous in this. And Rashi points out, Rashi was the great interpreter of the Bible, lived from 1040, I think it was, till 1105, lived in Troyes, in France, T-R-O-Y-E-S, In France, he's considered to be the prominent biblical interpreter in terms of giving simple interpretations of the Bible. Rashi comments on this verse, you know, people, a simple little verse, that Moses and Aaron went in to talk to Israel. What does Rashi say? When Moses and Aaron go back to the Israelites, they are all agreed, yeah, we got to get freedom, we got to be free, and they start out en masse. The elders of Israel, the leaders of each of the clans, and Moses and Aaron, and they start out to go to talk to Pharaoh. And one by one, they say, I got something else to do. I better go home and take care of, you know. One by one, they drop out, and here in chapter 5, Exodus chapter 5, Moses and Aaron are left, and they go in to talk to Pharaoh. We here in this holy village are, in a sense, those who are left, who have to talk to the pharaohs of our time. Have a good day.